We're calling next week's Big Band Jump program Moments in Music. Anecdotes about the production of some of the recordings and the change in careers of some of the recording artists. Moments in Music, the stories behind the music on the next Big Band Jump. And we hope you'll be with us.
Hi, this is Mike Chilson of the RC Scale Builder Show. If you're interested in radio control scale modeling, you should check us out at rcscalebuilder.com. It's a great community that offers build threads, tips and tricks, aircraft walkarounds, free plans, and much more. You can find us at www.rcscalebuilder.com. Hope to see you there.
The RC Scale Builder Show, broadcast weekly, right here on Warbird Radio. Hey, good morning, friends. Thanks for joining us this morning. It is the big Tuesday show here of Warbird Radio Live. Glad you were able to make it up with us this morning. It is raining like crazy down here this morning, here in beautiful Bon Air, Georgia, just outside of, not too far from the gates of Robins Air Force Base. But, man, it's coming down outside today. Just watching it let the dogs run around a little bit, and they ran right back in. Hope it's better weather where you're listening to us at this morning. Maybe some flying weather out there for you. Anyhow, we have a great guest joining us this morning, Mr. James Carter, all the way from Melbourne, and not Melbourne, Florida. Isn't that right, James? But a little further south than that. You're joining us. You're joining us from our sister studio down there in Melbourne, Australia, here to talk about the Broken Wings program and documentary that you're currently making. And when I found this, we were talking earlier, and I said, I don't remember when it was that I first saw this, but it was, I want to say it was several years ago, maybe a year or two ago, and I was just doing something. I was looking up a Spitfire for some reason, or researching Spitfires, and then, bang, here's this, at first I thought, I was like, man, these guys, what are they talking about? 12 Spitfires buried in a... in a hole. is this a joke? What is this? And it looks very authentic. And now here we are. We'll call it 2 years later. And I'm talking to you on the phone. So let me ask you officially now: is this real, James? Is this really something that that's going on? Because to the aviation enthusiast out there, this is really something cool.
It's one of those once in a million opportunities that seems to come along that you just have to grab it with all your might.
Right.
In answer to your question, we believe it's true. We are convinced that up in Queensland, which is in the northern part of Australia, that there are a number of Spitfires buried in the ground up there that were put there for one of a number of reasons at the conclusion of World War II, and we are doing our utmost to try and find them. But at the same time, we want to tell the whole story, the whole back end of this thing as to why they're there, how they got there, which is why we're producing a documentary along the way to document not only our story of discovery, but a little bit of the history behind the whole thing and how they got there in the first place.
Do you need any help? I'm ready to come and find one. What a cool thing to do, James. And I want to admit that I didn't even say this, but you are one of the producers on the project, and you're not really an aviation archaeologist. You make your living by writing advertisements. And you met up with the filmmaker who helped you in your day job, I guess I should say.
Yeah, it's pretty much how it started. We both were put together. Carl is a director and a cinematographer, and he was asked to, I guess, basically tender for one of our projects that we were doing that was, I think, for the Australian Navy we were working at the time, because I used to work for the advertising agency that handles the Australian Navy, Army and Air Force recruiting advertising, which is similar to the recruiting advertising you have over there in America. And Carl and I got together, and we got along very well, and we found we had similar interests in everything from radio-controlled aircraft to warbirds to Apple computers to just a whole variety of different things. And as the friendship grew, And we went about our job of, you know, we're out interviewing on this particular job sailors about, you know, their life and, you know, what they do in the Navy, and that then grew to the Army and Air Force. And you finish the serious side of things and you end up, you might go and have a beer with these guys at the local bar or on base somewhere at an officer's mess, or, and invariably the conversation will turn to some of the lighter moments or some of the more unusual moments. And time again, these stories started coming out about these buried aircraft. There's been rumours throughout the Australian military from all three services for the past sort of 40-odd years that there are these aircraft buried somewhere, you know, up in Queensland, and they're just waiting to be discovered. And as we kind of heard about them, we thought, no, it can't be true. It's too fanciful. But I guess I just sort of thought, well, why don't we just have a bit of a look into this?
That's what I was wanting to find out. I mean, at what point do you and Kyle sit there and go, eh, you know, what the heck? Let's go find them. It was, you know, like, we've heard enough of this. Let's go find these things. Was there a moment like that where it was sort of, are we really going to do this? Are we really going to go try and find 12 buried Spitfires?
Are we nuts? There was a moment.
There was, okay.
There was a moment. I cannot for the life of me remember when it was. I remember all the early stuff where I was doing research and Carl was doing research, and we were kind of coming together and going, oh, well, have you heard about this? I heard this from here, and I found this in this museum, and we went to the National Archives and we found this and this, and all the pieces started coming together. And the more we found out, the more we started to think there's something in this, that it's got to be more than just rumour. And it was at that point we went, well, hang on, if we think this is a good idea, then maybe other people will too. Why don't we try and turn this into some sort of a documentary of discovery and actually follow our journey as we try and find these aircraft? Mm. And that's what we've been doing for the past 9 years now.
Wow. It's been going on that long now. This is not something that you woke up yesterday and said, let's go do it. I mean, this has been a long project, and you're getting close. In watching the trailer that we do have on our website, warbirdradio.com, which you can all take a look at right now, it's rather convincing. Those look like landing gear parts that you've stumbled upon.
They certainly are. I've got the one that I've got is sitting about 6 feet from me on a little timber rack that we built for it, and we confirmed it was off a Spitfire. Carl has got another one of the Oleo struts from a Spitfire as well. And in the same location where we found those, we also found Kitty Hawk struts and some other ones we haven't yet identified, but there was just dozens of these that had obviously been tossed down this old mine at the end of the war. And we sort of look at this and go, well, it's not quite a whole aircraft, but it goes some way to proving that they were disposing of aircraft parts, at least in a very haphazard way at the end of the war, simply just to get rid of them. So while it is a great leap to go from aircraft parts to a whole aircraft, it just sort of, it pushes things along a little further into the believability side of things, rather than, you know, if we'd found nothing to this point, you would start to go, well, maybe it is just myth, or maybe it is just legend that grew out of stories at the end of World War II. But when you start finding tangible evidence of aircraft parts, you stand there dumbfounded just thinking, well, what else is buried under the ground?
Now, how are you going about searching for these? I'm sure that the big part of this is, well, you take money and you turn it into research equipment. But how is this going? Well, what type of means are you using to find these airplanes?
I guess there's two sides to it. There's the initial research and investigation phase, which has been going on for years, where we've tried to uncover every piece of physical evidence that may suggest an area where these aircraft may be. And a lot of that has come out of the National Archives in Australia here, which is very similar to the archives in the United States, where all, you know, important documents dating back to when Australia first became a nation are all stored here, and that includes military records. So it's taken months and months to go through their records, and of course they say that only 10% of all their records are actually catalogued and on the shelves. So it's a bit of an investigation to try and actually find what we're looking for. So I guess that's one side of it. Then there's where we actually went up to Queensland, went to the spot where we thought they were, and we went around and interviewed people up there. We interviewed people in their 80s and 90s who gave us all sorts of little tangible bits and pieces and their take on the story. And then you start overlaying what we found in the archives with what people have told us, then what we've heard from military personnel. Then you start doing things as basic as pulling up Google Earth. You can pull up Google Earth and look at the area now. And there's little things there that say if you compare those shots with aerial photographs taken in 1945, which we also had, we had those blown up to about 8 feet square, so they were massive. And you can actually start picking things out, and there are things that just don't look right. Now, it may be nothing, but you put a circle around that and go, right, when we get up to Oakey in Queensland, we'll look at that. So there's that side of it. Then you have to go and do things like the stories say a lot of these aircraft will put down mines. So you go and talk to the mines department up in Queensland and you start finding out more there. And this gradual building up of information so that we don't waste time just going up there and sort of standing going, well, let's try over there just because it looks right.
Right.
Or, you know, and you need to very carefully do your investigation, do your research, then go up there and investigate those places with the greatest chance of success. Now, to do that, the last time we went up, it was purely shovel and spade, and we did a bit of digging, and not very far below the surface were these oleostruts. Now, that was probably...
So these are right under the surface then at this point.
They were just under the surface.
Which tells you that they were indeed burying aircraft up there, which I see what you're saying. That would certainly further along the late-night barroom talk. You know, maybe exactly. We're just an inch further.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. But what we want to do, the next phase is probably the most important. What we were hoping to do initially was to do a magnetometer or ground penetrating radar survey from the air. And there's a couple of companies around the world that actually do this for large mining companies. There's a number of them based in Australia because we have such massive mineral deposits throughout the country. They will fly vast tracts of the Australian desert and scan the ground looking for iron ore deposits or uranium deposits or gold deposits. We thought we could employ that technology here. Unfortunately, they've told us that it's very easy to spot a large iron ore body that might be 5 miles long by 3 miles deep by, you know, 20 miles right. wide. But when you look at an aircraft from above, the only thing that is going to be picked up is the engine, because that has the majority of ferrous metals in it that will be seen by the ground penetrating radar. The rest of the aircraft is almost invisible. And the chances of spotting that, even with a very slow flying helicopter sitting at around 20 feet off the ground, they said you could fly straight over it and you wouldn't see it. So what that now means is we have to go back and scan the areas that we believe hold the most hope by hand and walk it on the ground.
With this technology that you're talking about?
Using okay. commonly available ground-penetrating radar or magnetometer-type equipment, which is the sort of stuff that you could go out to your local gold prospecting shop and, you know, you borrow a metal detector. These are just a glorified metal detector that are just far more sensitive to disturbances under the ground and and that sort of thing. So
in theory pick up the fuselage then. I'm guessing that the engines might be separate, or were they believed to be on the airframe already?
No, we believe that when the aircraft, what would happen is the Supermarine factory in England would build an aircraft, test fly it, they'd bring it back to the factory, then disassemble it only so far. They'd take the main wings off, they would take the tail section off as one unit, and they'd leave the engine in and then put them basically in one large crate with the wings sort of sitting down the side of the fuselage. I mean, you're talking a crate the size of, you know, a 40-foot shipping container, so it's a large crate. But what they would do is, prior to actually putting them in the crate, they would wrap them either with, there's a like a brown waxy paper they used to wrap rifles and guns in before putting them into timber boxes to stop the air and anything getting into the metals and rusting them. We believe they wrapped them in that, and in some cases they actually sprayed the aircraft with a I guess you'd call it a rust inhibitor, which was like a rubber solution. Because of the journey from England to Australia took months, the salt air would begin to corrode the aluminium frames of the aircraft. So they'd put this inhibitor over them, then put them in the timber boxes to help, you know, get them here in one piece prior to reassembly at a base such as this one up in Queensland before being flown up to the front lines.
So I guess when you're saying the original container, for some reason I knew this was a depot later on at the end of the war, so I was thinking that they were disassembled. But these are new airplanes in the box, still in the original, and when you say original shipping containers, you mean the original shipping containers as from the factory, not from the depot. Okay, now this makes sense. So these are complete airplanes buried in a mine shaft. Now that's a big box to put down
a mine shaft.
It would be a big mine shaft. So it would seem if you knew where that was, you could maybe go look there, but I'm sure it's not that easy. sure it's not that easy. it's like, just go find the mine, James. Let's go. Come on.
But, precisely.
But not that easy.
In one sense, it is that easy. In another sense, it's not that easy because we have so many stories of these aircraft being dropped down mine shafts. Now, there's a real danger there that if they did drop them down the mine shaft, they may have dropped 100, 200, 300 feet. Now, by the time they hit the bottom, they're not going to be in very good shape now.
No.
Well, they wouldn't have been in very good shape after they were dropped. So that would be a great shame. But we're actually not sure whether they were dropped down the shaft. We actually think the parts, we know of one mine shaft where there are Merlin engines stacked end on end up the shaft. There are dozens of Merlin engines, which we kind of thought, well, maybe we start with that because we know where that is. See if we can recover the Merlin engines and use that as a stepping stone to try and recover the Spitfire.
I mean, this is the mother load of warbirds that you're talking about. You realize that? I mean, this is unheard of.
This is what is so incredible, that if it turns out to be true, it will be the first time anywhere in the world that a 0 hours airframe has been found, you know, buried in its original crate, essentially to be put back together and flown. Now, obviously, it won't, because I'm sure time will have had an effect on them somewhat.
Well, but still, I mean, it is a possibility that you're looking at a zero-time airframe, which is unheard of in an original airframe. You know, my next question, I think, is probably on the minds of a lot of folks. Who owns these airplanes at this point? Are they still owned by the RAF? How does that work?
What actually happened was, and we've got all the documentary evidence on this, again, from the National Archives. I've got original letter, not the originals because they're held by the archive. I have copies of the original letters from the High Commissioner in England at the end of the war, stating that England has no further use for these Spitfires and the Australian government may do with them as they see fit. So England has, or the RAF, I guess, the English government, has handed over ownership back to Australia. So that gets rid of one problem. The okay. second one is we've got the document.
I know where this is going, but that's so the Brits are out. Now you're dealing with the Australian government. Okay.
Correct. What we also have is copies of the write-off document that actually writes the aircraft off the books. It's, as they say, that they've struck them off charge from the Royal Australian Air Force. And that was done by, there was a government department called the Disposals Commission at the end of the war, which was charged with getting rid of everything to do with the war and getting as much money as they possibly could back on it. So we've got the write-off documents. That now means the Australian government and the Royal Australian Air Force have no right over the aircraft as well. So that's good for us.
Right.
Where it becomes a little bit tricky is if we find them on private property, even though we've done all the work and we may pay for all the excavation and everything else to get one out, the landowner has first right of ownership on whatever is found on his property. So we've kind of thought, well, I guess you just have to come to an arrangement with the property owner and do a deal, basically.
Or buy it.
Or buy it, exactly.
Which might be cheaper if you're talking about, Merlin engine stack to that. I mean, I don't know what this property would sell for, but that brings up an interesting point, though. What kind of land are we dealing with? You think of Queensland, you're not thinking... this is not exactly waterfront property that you're talking about.
No, you're talking about your typical pastures with maybe a few head of cattle grazing on it. That's pretty much it. It's fairly barren. It's not desert by any means, but it's certainly not lush forest or, some sort of tropical environment that you get further up north, because the area we're talking about is quite close to the New South Wales border. So it's if you looked at Australia, it's sort of through the middle. So it's not a very hot, arid climate, and it's not a tropical climate.
It's a perfect climate, though, for keeping a Spitfire preserved, it sounds like.
It is a perfect climate. It's quite hot and dry out there. So if you could pick an environment, apart from being frozen under the ice in Greenland, as other people have discovered, it is a very good environment because there's no salt air. Hopefully, because they've been under the ground, there's a certain preservation that may have taken place there. Hopefully, the soil hasn't got too damp and maybe the timber boxes have rotted. The area they are in is quite dry, so we may be lucky.
Well, I think that's interesting. I want to mention to everyone who's just joining us this morning, my guest is James Carter. He is currently seeking to find all of these Spitfires that are at other aircraft that are believed to be buried at an old abandoned airfield in Queensland. Now, these are thought to be down mine shafts and just possibly even buried in trenches. They were left there after the war for various reasons. If you'd like to ask James a question this morning, certainly feel free to call in. The number to dial, 478-787-4768. You can also reach us on Skype this morning if you're calling internationally. Just type in Warbird Radio, and that will pull us up right there on Skype. You can also send an email. An email question will go great this morning. The address to send it to, it's Matt, M-A-T-T, at warbirdradio.com. Now, James, we do need to pause just for a quick minute here, but I'm hoping that when you come back, you can fill us in on a couple of more interesting aspects of this, like who else is searching for it and when the next expedition is, because I'm sure there's some interesting stories there, and I want to hear all about them. We'll be right back with more Warbird Radio right after this.
This is Warbird Radio.
We're calling next week's Big Band Jump program Moments in Music, anecdotes about the production of some of the recordings and the change in careers of some of the recording artists. Moments in Music, the stories behind the music on the next Big Band Jump, and we hope you'll be with us.
Hi, this is Mike Chilson of the RC Scale Builder Show. If you're interested in radio control scale modeling, you should check us out at rcscalebuilder.com. It's a great community that offers build threads, tips and tricks, aircraft walk-arounds, free plans, and much more. You can find us at www.rcscalebuilder.com. Hope to see you there.
The RC Scale Builder Show, broadcast weekly, right here on Warbird Radio. And welcome back to Warbird Radio Live. My guest today, James Carter, joins us from Melbourne, Australia, talking about what is absolutely the mother lode of all warbirds. And James, you're searching right now for, it's believed to be 12 Spitfires that are buried under the ground, along with maybe some other airplanes. You've already mentioned that you've discovered a Kitty Hawk, which is a P-40, the landing struts for a P-40 that are over there. So Lord knows what else is over there, buried right under the surface of the earth. This is amazing. I mean, this has to be, if it's proven true, one of the greatest finds as far as World War II aviation goes. In the history, I would assume, of collection. This is unbelievable. This is one of those things that you hear about after the war where guys were buying airplanes for $500. This might be even better. All you have to do is go dig it up. I mean, you know, that's... It's rather amazing. It's sort of like the airport, you know, is closed. The guys were in a hurry to leave. They shoved this stuff out of every, in every hole they could find just to get rid of it. So, rather amazing. And I'm hoping that it proves to be true. But share with me a little bit on this. I'm sure that you don't mention this, and then you don't have two guys go searching for it, that other folks don't start saying, well, hey, why not go try this? Is this been a problem, or... is this such a remote place that no one else is looking for it at this point?
No, it's certainly not remote. It's probably 2 hours west of Brisbane. Brisbane, if you know, Queensland is, right. is on the coast there. So it's an easy drive along major highways into very, very pretty country towns with, you know, typical locals and lots of bars and pubs to drink at. It's a normal country town, but it's just caught up in this incredible tale that it hasn't haunted the town, but it's been a part of town folklore and legend since soon after the war when the stories first started coming out. And it's been with the town ever since. And now over those past, well, it's now, 60 years, there have been a number of searches by other interested parties to try and find them, the majority of which I've got to point out have done it purely for the financial gain. It was let's go and make $1 million and find a Spitfire, right. and their attempts have been very haphazard, which hasn't been good for us because there are a number of property owners in the area who are very wary of people coming onto their property because they've had countless people over the past 40-odd years knocking on their door saying, have you got a Spitfire buried in your backyard?
Do you know that you might have one? Right. So this is the proverbial book salesman that comes to the door and says, hey, let
precisely.
You know. Okay. Well, and that's, I guess in a way that could be good for you if you approach this with a more scientific background and say, look, you know, this is we're a real expedition. Let's pause for just a moment here and play this trailer. I think it'll play here for the folks at home to hear it who have still yet to visit the website and take a look at it. But let's just pause for a moment, and maybe you can talk to us about some of the people who are in here. Let's see if this will work here. Let's try this. And here we go. This is the trailer from Broken Wings.
They were just left there, the malachites were just left there around the mine.
Of course, they just left the gate and big hole in the ground, and then eventually it just all shut up.
They decided to establish an aircraft depot here, which was a maintenance facility.
At the end of the Second World War, Oakey became a major storage area.
Between 550 planes, and quite a picture.
Boomerangs, Kitty Hawks, Spitfires and Mustangs here at that stage.
It must have been incredible days, actually, to see all these aircraft, hundreds, literally hundreds of them.
I didn't count it as an aircraft. Didn't look like one, didn't smell like one.
It looked
far beyond what you could comprehend.
It was just like a sea of aircraft, all neatly lined up.
Just mass.
And nobody really cared.
Came to the base to be engaged in breaking up the fighters that were here on the base at that time.
But I don't believe they got the absolute last.
But the stories of Spitfires down mine shafts keeps popping up all the time.
Almost immediately at the end of the war, trucks left this place loaded up and they'd go off in various directions.
They were away for about an hour and they came back and they were empty.
I remember the drive-through theatre that was here once had the reputation of having Spitfires buried under it.
Wherever there was an available hole in the ground, whether it be an abandoned mine or a gully that they could fill in, they dumped stuff.
The time that I was here on the base, that 6 months, I would have thought that I would have heard something, the myths or whatever you like to call them, about the buried aircraft.
Aircraft components were placed in mine shafts, every hole in the ground around the area for disposal purposes.
Not assembled aircraft, they would have been aircraft in crates.
Now they could see the plane still wrapped up in packing crates and everything laying down in the bottom of the shaft.
Everything was accounted for in our service, every bullet, every item.
Looking back, in hindsight, I'd say the security was null and void.
Kids were able to get in here. I mean, it wasn't fence security that there is today.
Somebody had come along with an old Dodge 4 running on peeled carrot, off into Oakley, away we'd go.
I believe they had guard dogs and that sort of thing, but crikey, they could have been more pets than anything.
But the Alsatian dogs were along the back line. We all knew them by name. We could go up and talk to them and pat them on the back and we'd go in.
I believe that there is only one story that I have any total genuine acceptance of.
A first-hand account that Nev and four of his mates actually dug a hole with pick and shovel over a number of weeks. They buried a box with a Spitfire in it.
He was here at the end of the war. They were told that they couldn't leave the Air Force until their hangars were empty.
He said to his boss one day, you know, when are we getting out? And he said, well, as soon as that last aircraft is gone.
There was a bulldozer working nearby.
And they got him over and he dug a trench beside the hangar.
And the aeroplane was put in it.
Maybe there is some credibility to these stories because it's probably the one story that does keep coming up.
We need to keep looking. What we need to do is put it to bed once and for all.
You know, the mind can't help but wander, you know, and you think about taking a shovel and striking out on what would be the ultimate treasure hunt.
Come and have a look at this. I think we've hit gold here. This is not farm machinery. This here, parts of airplanes, I am certain of it.
James, I'm telling you, man, when you walk up, I'm guessing that's you who walks up there and
yes, that is
sees these airplanes. My goodness, I mean, it just gives me chills to think about all of these airplanes just buried under the ground right there. Just amazing. Absolutely amazing. And, of course, if you'd like to see the trailer for yourself, you can log on at warbirdradio.com. It's the first story up there and take a look at this. And it'll be up there all day today. But then also we have a link to your website, which is Broken Wings. And you can take a look at the entire project there. These interviews are fantastic, though, by the way. I mean, you guys have really done a fine job of collecting all of these characters up and really presenting both sides of the story. So
well,
I commend you for
that.
This
was what we really wanted to show both sides of the story. And rather than go in there blindly saying, we know where the Spitfires are, we believe they're there, and just going in with this blinkered view of everything, what we wanted to do was weigh up both sides of the story of those that say, no, it's impossible, it's too fanciful, it's crazy, it's legend, and then counter that with those that go, well, no, we have pulled planes out of the ground before, we have got them back to flying condition, so why should these stories be any different? And all the way through, we have one side of the story and then a counter to that story, and we try and keep it as balanced as we possibly can throughout the documentary.
Well, I think it's coming along really greatly, and I think it's just a fantastic story that you have, and I wish you the best of luck. I do want to ask though, what's next? What's right around the bend here? Because it looks like you're right on the cusp of something really cool, a major discovery, I would go as far to say.
We believe we're very close. The problem, of course, excuse me, is time and money, which is always a problem, because up until this point, Carl and I have funded it entirely ourselves and pulled in a lot of favours from people, and because, you know, we want to do this properly, and so we've chosen to shoot the whole thing on high def and so that we get the best possible result. But of course, shooting high def costs a lot of money, and even with favours, it's got to the point now where we need to get some funding from somewhere to continue not only the search but the documentary itself. Then we need the time to go back up to Queensland, and we think probably spend 4 to 6 weeks, because just walking the areas we have in mind, you're only scanning an area about 5 feet wide with each pass. Now, if we want to do it properly, we think we need about 2 to 3 weeks of 8-hour days walking with these ground-penetrating radar to very accurately and very carefully plot out the areas and search every spot we believe there might be something. So again, of course, you know, there's, well, where do you find 3 weeks? We've both got full-time jobs, so then maybe we have to take time off work, but then to do that, we need the money to be able to fund us,
right,
to be able to, right, to stay up there for 3 weeks. So there's almost a catch-22 there of trying to work out how to take it forward on what little resources we have between us. I mean, we did an interview about 3 weeks ago with Judy Pay, which some of your listeners may know. She has just recently restored the only P-40F in the world, and she's done an absolutely beautiful job on the restoration. We went down to her hangar, which is in a funny little aerodrome called Tyab, which is about 45 minutes southeast of Melbourne. And anyone can drop down there to a hangar and knock on the door and pop in and have a look. And she's got some wonderful aircraft down there. But we thought, let's get a collector's and restorer's perspective on what she feels would be the reaction if an aircraft was found. So we're doing little bits along the way where we can, where we see an opportunity that won't break the bank and won't have our wives, you know,
right,
picking up
right,
a bit of a fuss, you know. We'll, right, Carl and I will go out for a day and interview someone else that we can do locally. It's this next bigger stage that we really have to try and find a way of getting that moving, and I guess doing it before some other person goes up there and finds them before us.
Right. It's sort of a race. But, you know, the great thing about this is, regardless of what you come away with, the idea in everyone's heart that there are still airplanes waiting to be found is still alive no matter what happens. I mean, even if you, right, go up there and you come away and you say, look, you know, there are no airplanes up there, there's still folks who are going to say, ah, what do they know? They didn't look down the right hole. And so this idea that I think in a way drives a lot of us in this, you know, who have this passion for these old airplanes.
Passion. You're right, man.
I think it's great. It still keeps that alive. It's for some point. You know, my dream is to always, you know, walk onto some farm and then open the hangar door or the barn door up, and
yes,
then there's the airplane in the corner, you know, tattered and ready to be restored. But this is something that, this is like a treasure hunt for, you know, for airplanes. It's sort of like the pirates buried the treasure, and now you just have to go find it. And the great thing is, you have maps, you have government records, which, you know, I'm sure there's a good joke in there somewhere, but you have, you know, you have mine shafts, you have, I mean, it's the perfect adventure movie, and it's set, of course, in Queensland.
We always look at the film's National Treasure with Nicolas Cage. We kind of
right.
Carl and I actually like watching those because there's little elements in there that we can go, hey, that's us, we're doing that, and
right,
we kind of associate. I know we're not talking about the same sort of subject matter here, but we can identify with this character being totally obsessed in finding something of,
right,
that is of great value to not only themselves, but, you know, to, in the case of National Treasure, it was to America or to humanity, in fact. I mean, while we're not as grand as that.
Well, I think you're in line with Raiders of the Lost Ark, at least. I mean, this is very Harrison Fordish, you know, running around the mine shafts and trying to find these
exactly
these holy grails, if you will, of the Warbird world. But so, are there any? What are the other airplanes that could possibly be buried as well? I'm guessing P-40s. Is that on the list, or is
could be P-40s?
Probably depoted could, P-40s. So,
yeah. Well, they actually maintained and assembled Spitfires, Kitty Hawks, Boomerangs, and Mustangs. So,
a bunch of lightweight airplanes up there. Nothing too heavy hitting. I'm just kidding.
No. It was only the
best
aircraft.
Only the best of the war.
So, exactly.
Right. They're all up there. Yeah. Just come find them, kids. Grab your ticket.
The heavier aircraft, the bombers, were all based down at Tokemoor, which is on the Victorian New South Wales border.
Right.
And if any of your viewers get to come down to Australia, they should go to Tokemoor and have a look at what's left there. It's quite an astounding place because at one point during World War II, it was the biggest Air Force base in the world with the sheer number of mainly American aircraft or bombers that were going through there.
Mm-hmm.
It's another astounding place. And there's stories of a Mitchell, I think it is, that's buried down at Tokemoor. So, I mean, we just keep hearing more and more. But, yeah, getting back to Oki, it could be Spitfire, Kitty Hawk, Boomerang, Mustang, but there is a little something else it could be, which would make it very interesting. There is a possibility it could be a Royal Navy Seafire, which was the Navy's version of the Spitfire that had the strengthened undercarriage, had a tow hook from the rear of the aircraft for landing on carriers.
Right.
Because the Royal Navy sent out to Australia a number of assembly teams that would be stationed at various locations putting together Seafires that could then be flown out to Royal Navy carriers, which were based off the Australian coast. Now, we know of a number of all the Seafires arrived in crates. We know that for a fact, and we know they were assembled here. And we believe that at the end of the war, the Royal Navy, once the war was over, they basically just downed tools and left. And we believe they may have left some of the crated aircraft here that they never got around to assembling. And there's also another bit of interesting evidence that suggests there may have been a ship on its way to Australia that left around July or August. And because the journey out here takes upwards of 3 months, the war may have ended while it was en route. It arrives in Australia loaded up with crates of aircraft. And it's, well, what do we do with these? Oki became basically the dumping ground for all fighter aircraft that had returned from the war. So any that had arrived here in crates were taken out there to be scrapped with the rest of the aircraft. So there's a number of other interesting little factors coming into play here.
Well, I would think at the worst-case scenario, that you've already proven this to be true, that there could be a real cache of parts out there for these airplanes, even if you never find a complete airplane, that seems like there must be, as you've proven, just stockpiles of parts, because they shoved them down and into these holes and everywhere else. But I think it's a fantastic story. It's whatever it is, I'm excited for you. I can't wait to see what you find out there on this next expedition. I just hope that it comes quickly.
Oh, so do we.
Maybe you guys who are listening tonight can book your Qantas tickets and head on down there, knock on James's door, and say, come on, let's go find a Spitfire. But I know it's not that easy. But when something comes on the calendar, please let us know. I think it would be fantastic to keep in touch and definitely keep the hunt and the story alive. I think it's fantastic, James.
Oh, no, we will definitely keep in touch. And it's always great to have interest from the other side of the world. So we'll make sure we keep you in the loop, and we can have another chat. And next time I'll try and get Carl in on the conversation as well, so you can hear it from his side of things.
Oh, I think that's fantastic. Now, in the meantime, I have to ask. I noticed the radio controlled aircraft hanging up in there. Do you have a Spitfire yet, or are you just waiting for the real one?
I'm waiting for the real one. Yes, I have a PC-9, which is based on the Royal Australian Air Force Roulettes, who are the precision flying team for the Air Force out here. You've got the Blue Angels in America for the US Air Force.
Right, right.
And, I've got a rather large-scale radio-controlled plane.
Well,
it just sort of hangs in the back of my study amongst all the other bits and pieces and things that my wife goes, why do you really need that on the shelf?
Right. Well, hey, you know, it's as we say, I say this a lot on this show, but it's amazing what men find beautiful, isn't it? So
exactly.
Well, best of luck, and please stay in touch with us and let us know when the next expedition is underway. And I'm surprised that there aren't some investors here in the U.S. who are interested in going down there and helping you with this venture. If they do want to get a hold of you, I'm certain that your email address is listed there on the Broken Wings website.
It certainly is.
Why not a shameless plug for it? Run down the website. Tell the guys how they can get a hold of you, Kyle.
If they go to www.brokenwings.com.au you'll find we've got there's a feedback form there where you can just fill in anything you want to send through to us, and we check it at least 5 times a day, hoping that someone's going to
send a big check.
Send a big check or something. So, you're more than happy to hear from anyone.
All right. Well, James, thank you very much, and please give our best to Kyle, and happy hunting.
Will, Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks again. My guest this morning, Mr. James Carter down there from Melbourne, Australia, who is on the hunt for the motherlode of all warbirds right down there in Queensland. Believed to be a number of airplanes buried just under the surface, possibly in mine shafts. What a story. I told you this was going to be a show you were going to be talking about for years to come, and I hope it's not that long before they find something. Hey, mark your calendars for tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. The EAA is going to be on the program tomorrow. I'm so excited about this, but Bill Fisher, who is the executive director of EAA Warbirds of America, is going to be joining us tomorrow to talk about everything that's going on there at the EAA. Then Thursday, Bob Russell will be joining us from Warbirds and Warriors, the big air show out in Charlotte and Monroe, North Carolina. They're going to talk about all the stuff going on out there. That's going to be fantastic. You know, they're expecting over 100,000 people this year to attend that air show. We're going to get the big scoop on it. What's going to happen this year? That's on Thursday. So we'll see you tomorrow again with Bill Fisher, who will be joining us from EAA Warbirds. That's going to be a fantastic show, so get your Warbird questions ready tomorrow. Again, my thanks to James Carter from Broken Wings for being our guest this morning, and thanks to you for supporting and listening to Warbird Radio. Stay tuned. There's more Warbird Radio programming coming up right after this. Stay tuned.